images to me aren't about representation, but they're about creating the emotional and psychological context for the story and for the characters that allows the viewer to participate in the story.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Chartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 497. If this recording doesn't sound that spectacular, it's probably because I'm recording this on my iPhone. I'm not at home, and I didn't bring all my equipment, and so therefore I just decided this is going to be a brief intro anyway, because this is all about the episode itself, where I have on one of the great cinematographers from the last 50 years. This is Ed Lachman. On FilmWax Radio, I have been attending the New York Film Festival for, probably about a dozen years. And every year during the press and industry screenings that I attend, which happen pretty soon, actually, like in the next month or two, Ed Lachman's always there. And I've seen him there for years. And I don't know what it was. I just, every time there was a Todd Haynes film, because he's always been shooting those, I guess I figure, well, I'm just going to go through the publicist and get him on with Todd Haynes and Christine Vachon and you know, that whole team. And it just never seems to materialize. So finally, what happened? Oh, I walked right up to him, walked right up to him and I said, hey, I'd love you to do my podcast. He gave me his email and we knocked it out. It just all happened really over a very short amount of time once the ball got rolling, and he was terrific. He's been around for a number of decades. He's been involved in so many films. I mean, his first credit is The Lords of Flatbush, for Pete's sake, which came out in 1974. I'm just going to name a few films on which he's either served as cinematographer: Lightning Over Water, Say Amen, Somebody, Desperately Seeking Susan, David Byrne's True Stories, Less Than Zero, London Kills Me, Light Sleeper, for a recent FilmWax guest, Paul Schrader, Theremin, An Electronic Odyssey, a very, very entertaining documentary, The Limey, for Soderbergh, The Virgin Suicides, for Sofia Coppola, Aaron Brockovich, again for Soderbergh. Oh, and then we're going to talk about his collaborations with Todd Haynes. I think everything since Far From Heaven. But in between, also, he worked on the last Robert Altman film, A Prairie Home Companion. He shot Import, Export, I'm Not There, Life During Wartime, Howl, the HBO Mildred Pierce teleseries, Paradise Love, Paradise Faith, Paradise Hope, Wiener Dog, Wonderstruck. And he's got two films coming up, The Seville Communion and Viewers. I'm not familiar with them, but check them out. Anyway, I don't want to waste too much more of your time. Thank you for putting up with this. We're going to have a nice long conversation with one of the great cinematographers who's worked with everybody, as you can tell from that long list. And I didn't even read all the titles. That was just select titles from his illustrious career. He's a sweet guy. He's totally engaged. This is my conversation with Ed Lachman here on FilmWax Radio. There will be no outro, and we'll be back in a few days with a brand new episode of the podcast. Let me set the stage anyway while you're looking, because we are at the loft, right? This is your home, though, too, I assume. You live here as well as work here, right? This is the nerve center. Anyway, Ed Lachman, this is your workspace we're sitting in right now, and you have a manila folder set up for each film that you've worked on. Is that the idea?
Well, over the years,
well,
you know,
perfect.
Doing interviews and
sure. You've done a few.
I do a few. When I do research for a film, maybe you don't have to be there.
Oh, okay. Is if you hold it on like that with your elbow in your lap, as
yeah,
long as
sure,
that's comfortable,
sure.
I mean, yeah.
I'll swoop in a different
No, it's fine.
Thank
it's
you,
fine.
Noah. Noah's the intern. He's just trying to help.
Over the years, I always do a lot of research with the director, and especially with Todd Haynes. So I start a folder for each film, really actually a booklet, with ideas, research. So then at the end of the project, when you actually have to then come up with ideas like why you did it after the fact.
Oh, you can repurpose it now. Oh, that's interesting.
I see. You doing it and intellectualizing it are two different things.
Yeah.
So then that's another evolution to the ideas with the project.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, many times I even interview Todd with myself to get all our ideas out. So when we go out and we talk about the film, we're kind of in sync about what the thematic, the aesthetic.
Right. And I'm thinking, I'm looking up above you. There are some bookshelves just painting the picture. And I see there's a plaque or some sort of sign of Crickcarrel, which is two films back, your two collaborations back. You did shoot Wonderstruck. You did shoot that one, right?
I did that one.
Thought so. I'm right here in front of me, too.
It shot me, too.
It shot you. I wonder what you mean by that.
Well, I don't know.
Okay. Play on words.
You always have a few holes in you when you finish a film.
I would imagine you would. But I'm just thinking, okay, that movie was a period piece, and so that must have been far more work. But then, of course, that's nonsense because
if you look at the work I've done with Todd since Far From Heaven, they've covered the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s,
mm-hmm.
to the 70s.
And that was all in the I'm Not There movie, just that, right? Almost every year.
Almost all those in I'm Not There, epic poem essay to Bob Dylan.
Right.
But so it's always researching because Todd doesn't look mm-hmm. for his approach through just cinematic language, but through the demographics, the political, the social, the art movements of the time, and all those give us ideas about how we're going to look at the period
mm-hmm.
to tell the stories. Because images to me aren't about representation, but they're about creating the emotional and psychological context for the story and for the characters that allows the viewer to participate in the story.
Okay. So you have open right now one of these folders, correct? With that, the research, is that one of them right there, just arbitrarily? Because I was going to ask you if maybe...
I was going to plagiarize. I just was at Cannes. I had a tribute at Cannes.
Yeah, I heard about it.
Got this award at Cannes.
Which award was it?
The Ingenue and Cannes give an award for the last 6 years. And last year was Chris Doyle. The year before was Peter Pszczycki. The year before that was Roger Deakins. So I have Philippe Russolo. So I was in
a great
group. But, this was an unbelievable honor because historically, believe it or not, even though France is the birth of cinema, maybe disputable,
arguably.
But it certainly could be considered.
Lumiere, however you pronounce it.
They don't have an actual award for cinematography. And so Ingenue, the lens manufacturer, approached Cannes also through a French... Pierre-William Glenn, Truffaut's cinematographer, who's actually very active in Cannes. He's head of all the projections at Cannes. And they instituted this award for cinematographer, which is more of a lifetime tribute mm-hmm. to your work And so actually I was going to, what you asked me, what I was looking at, part of my speech was about, you know, what do we do as cinematographers, which I thought that might fit your show, right? That's what you want to talk about.
Well, I'm just going to speak for the people
listening.
We could
talk about anything.
That's exactly what I was going to say. For those listening to this, they're going to, I should say, we could talk about whatever you want, whatever on your mind, but this is perfect, sure.
But I thought, well, why not talk about that? That's that's
it's a good way in.
Something I almost know something about. So not to sound obvious, you know, but of course we translate our stories into images with the director's vision, a production designer's shape and form, the crew's skill and artistry, and the emotional sensitivity of art of the actors. But for me, the challenge of cinematography is revealing or trying to evoke the poetic or psychological authenticity of the image that this, in the story you're telling. So I thought that would be a good lead-in.
It is a good lead-in. Can you give, like, what's a great, where do you feel, and this is tricky, of course, I understand all questions are going to be tricky, but where do you think you may have come the closest, where you felt like that you had achieved that really, really, to a level where you really felt, really felt satisfied? Can you think of an example like that?
Well, I want to get this out, you know.
Okay.
Images aren't just about pleasing aesthetics, pictorial aesthetics, but somehow how you create the emotions in the story through the language. Because to me, what makes films different than theater or literature, it's the images that create the metaphors, the subtext for the story, filtered through the optics of the camera, using space and light and time. So I don't know if I can say there's certain films I've worked on that I don't know if they reach an audience, and then there's other films that reach an audience and you're surprised that it had such a response. Mm-hmm. Like Carol has this kind of universal response from people. It captured somehow the idea of what first love is, about the tenuousness of how you feel in a relationship. In that story, it deals with these two women's affections toward each other, but it's more universal the way it reached people.
Oh,
and it found a cinematic language to embrace those ideas. But then I look at a film like I'm Not There that probably didn't have as great a success, but was one of the greatest challenges for me, because we look at this essay poem of Bob Dylan filtered through the language of the 60s and 70s, culturally, politically, socially, how he affected the culture and how the culture affected him. And Todd's brilliant idea was to not show Dylan in his creative life through different personifications of who he represented, because he would reemerge and reinvent himself through every period and through every album, and really shun what he was, so he could move forward creatively.
Shed his skin, in a way, every few albums.
Yeah.
It would be a new... Right?
And so the challenge for me is that Todd wanted to use a cinematic language, because in a way, Dylan was an actor. In a way, he was recreating his own persona through a new image he would create of himself. And so what better way to do that was through the cinema of the 60s and 70s, from Godard, the Nouvelle Vague, and its sexual politics, to the Italian modernism of Fellini and Antonioni, mm-hmm. and to the neo-70s Westerns of Peckinpah and Altman.
Sure, sure.
So here I was coming to the set, and I had just shot in black and white the day before, you know, Masculine Feminine of Godard. And now today I was reinventing, you know, Altman in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. So that was kind of a real mind fuck. Can you say that on your show?
Yeah, you can say that.
That was a real mind fuck visually, like to re-enter a different world cinematically in a short period of time.
Yeah.
So that film really speaks to me also because it was my youth. I was growing up in New York, going to art school, and I was listening to Blonde on Blonde over and over again. But it, for me at that time, and even until I shot this film for Todd, I never thought you could put images to a Dylan song because Dylan created the images himself through his music. So by Todd reinventing the idea of Dylan through these different characters, these really allowed us to create what the language was visually of who Dylan was becoming. Does that answer that?
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. There's no
I know. There's
exact
no
formula on this, right? But just as a side.
But I mean, the point is that, and I think I said this maybe, is what's so brilliant about working with someone like Todd is we both were in art school. We both studied semiology, which is kind of the signs and meanings of what images
Vassar?
Represent.
But you were
no,
in
he went
school.
To Brown.
Oh, Brown, right? That's right.
Yeah,
with Christine.
He went to Brown and Christine Vachon.
That's where they met.
I went to Columbia,
Harvard,
Ohio University. It was the 60s, so I was like dropping out of school, you know, like whatever I was dropping out.
I understand your parents must have been thrilled. You drop out of Columbia, okay, yeah, landed in Harvard. I just think that's kind of funny because I'm thinking, oh, well, your parents, you know, felt, phew, we dodged that bullet.
Well, and Columbia was like the last resort because it was, you know, I had finally come back to New York. Yeah. And so,
by the way, was Dylan ever, I forget, was Dylan ever on the set of that film or did he come to see
he
the film afterwards?
He didn't even want to see the film.
He had no
film.
Interest at that point.
He did see it.
He did, but he had a
kid. But
just so
he
happens.
Gave us, I mean, look, Jeff Rosen was our contact, his manager. And obviously, Todd was very nervous because he had gone through his other project in which he couldn't use the music. So he had written, you know, Velvet.
Yeah, Velvet Goldmine.
Yeah. Velvet Goldmine, yes.
Very Hugh, good. You weren't on that one, so it's okay for you to forget.
All right. So so he wrote like a outline and gave it to Jeff, and Dylan approved it. And the amazing thing is Dylan gave us all rights to all the music, anything
amazing.
That he had said. In fact, all the dialogue in the film is actually from what Dylan had ever said or written or was in his music.
Oh, right. Anything that Dylan said in the movie.
Yeah. And so he never wanted to be involved. He when Todd reached out to him, he said, it's your vision, and left it at that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't impose any point of view or editorialize.
Right. Yeah, no, I got it. You know, speaking of Velvet Goldmine, he also didn't get the rights Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story either, right?
Right.
So he had been, that was two, you know, two cases.
Two.
Second time was Shame on Me, I guess. And, you know, so he wasn't going to go down that road a third time, right? I actually remember the time of when Carol was coming out, and I sat with the screenwriter, who wrote it again? What was her name?
Screenwriter. Was
Patricia. No, Highsmith, no, Highsmith, though. She obviously, was, she's long gone.
She was.
No, but who? Phyllis.
Yeah, Phyllis.
Phyllis. I sat with Phyllis. I think
Najee.
Najee. I sat with
Phyllis Najee.
I sat with Phyllis Najee for the podcast. I did something with Todd and with Christine. I was really lobbying for you, and I think you were traveling at the time.
Oh.
So it's been a few years. I've been trying to get you on the show, and I forget how I... you gave me your email address. I guess I was at one point asked Susan Norgut, because she, you know, he's always going to those New York Film Festival press screenings, and which I go to generally, too, and I remember seeing you there. You would wear a very noticeable hat. Your hat. The fall hat, I guess, right?
That's so people don't know I'm bald.
Oh, well. You didn't go for the hair weave. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I don't know if I go that far.
So Todd, your relationship with Todd, do you think is it a matter of, it's all about the chemistry, right? He gets you and you get him and you're able to achieve things.
Well, he challenges me.
He also pushes you still.
Because every project he approaches in a different way and tries to find a language to tell the story. And that to me is the best thing that can be for a cinematographer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think of a cinematographer like another actor. You give a certain kind of performance. Mm-hmm. And your relationship with the director, you know, some people say, oh, it's a marriage. I wouldn't go that far. But I would say it's a dance partner.
Oh, okay.
That you hear the same music,
yeah,
but are you in step? Do you complement each other as a dance partner would?
Mm-hmm.
And Todd and I don't always agree, but what we come up with is better than I think either of us have it. But he does his homework. He comes to the set with ideas, with a shot list. And so there's a way of going further with it, mm-hmm, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So the shot list he comes up with, generally speaking, on his own? Is that how it works?
He loves to do his own shot list. And then when we're in the set he's very open to alter it depending on the varies of the situation, the mm-hmm time, and
right,
the coverage. But he's very he conceptualizes how the story and the language of what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I do my own look. He does a lookbook. I do my own lookbook.
Well, I was going to say what your this folder sounded like, kind of a lookbook meets, I don't know.
Yeah, I do.
The research.
We all do kind of. Project. The art mm-hmm department does one.
Right.
I do one. Sandy Powell, the wardrobe designer.
Right.
Costume designer. We all do our own lookbooks, but obviously, he being the director has to have the overall view of what he takes from us.
Yeah, Judy Becker.
And in fact, in a strange way, when I go to talk to a director, when I read a script, let's say I'm being interviewed,
mm-hmm,
I always go to that meeting with the director with a lot of visual ideas of how I see the film could be expressed through images.
So when
and not all directors yeah are visual. It's really interesting. Some directors look at me like,
"Wow,
are you yeah trying to do my job?"
Really?
I've lost some jobs because they think I'm imposing, and that isn't my position. My position is I at least want a dialogue. I at least want to show I have ideas, even if they're not your ideas. But then let's use that as a basis to discover what makes this story specific visually. Because to me, all stories are unique in themselves to find the visual language. It's like one writer writes with a certain form and sound and shape to his words. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's the same way for me what a director seeks. And I also, maybe this is unfair, but I think in Europe, they have a longer tradition visually. If you really think of the American idiom in maybe abstract expressionism, maybe Hopper before that, you know, that we really didn't have our own visual, how can I say, movement, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And so I think we were more, came out of a more literary background.
Oh.
It's even the way scripts are written, interestingly enough. Scripts are written differently for the most part in Europe. Now, I'm talking, again, in an independent way.
Okay.
But scripts here are written purely through dialogue. When you read a script from Bertolucci or Werner Herzog or Ulrich Seidel, it's written in description and setting as much as the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought that was always odd, you mm-hmm. know, that we're talking about a visual medium. Now, to the other way of thinking, Godard doesn't write scripts anymore. The last 20 years, he says, films are about images, so he goes out and actually shoots ideas with his images and shows that to his producers to say that's the form that I want to tell a story in. I don't know if that got complicated.
No, I like to let it also, you know,
free association.
Well, that's fine, but I mean, I also like just to let it sink into and think about what you're saying as well. Well, I want to come back to Ulrich Seidel because that's another like collaboration that you have. But since we're, it's obvious, you know, and for my show, since Todd has been on twice and Christine's been on twice, just so happened because I love that whole what these guys are doing is very, you know, I enjoy it so much. And
well, I think Ulrich Seidel is an Austrian director,
right?
Is one of the most interesting contemporary directors in Europe today.
Yeah, how did you meet him, by the way?
Well,
before you start,
he's mixed narrative and documenting reality
mm-hmm.
in a way that the way they interface each other. Like, he has a concept, an idea for a story that he researches, and then he tries to find the people that are those characters. And he uses actors only when he can't find the characters to actually play themselves. Or if it's a more complicated kind of character, he's got to use an actor. But then he uses the actors with the non-actors,
mm-hmm.
but shot in the real locations that the events could happen in.
Yeah.
And then what is unique about what he does is he shoots the scene without dialogues written. So it's improvised, the dialogues. And after you do a take, maybe two takes, he says, thank you very much. And you come back the next day and reshoot the scene. And if the actor or non-actor says, what would you want me to do? What do you want me to say? He would say, what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
So he's documenting something about the interior world of the character, who they are themselves, in the situations that he sets up.
Mm-hmm.
And he does these tableaus visually, which I always say is like how someone could walk down the street and look at something, and then he uses a handheld camera that participates in the action, but not knowing where the people are going to end up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I find people are disturbed a lot of times by the subject matter, and they're not quite sure if he is exploiting the people because they're so emotionally raw. But I find him one of the most moralistic directors without being a moralist. Mm-hmm. He's moral without being moralistic.
As a sort of
because he's showing something about the frailness of our own human nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's such an honesty. I mean, we always say films are about the illusion of reality, but what is the reality of the illusion?
Mm-hmm.
So I find he holds a mirror up to the audience of things that we don't want to see in ourselves. And I think that's why he's so compelling.
Where do you enter into that once again in your collaborative?
Well, I did a film with Larry Clark, Ken Park. And,
yeah, I've heard about it. Yeah. I apologize.
You don't want to admit that you saw it.
I have a 14-year-old son, and I'm kidding. No, and Harmony Current was involved.
Yeah, he wrote the script. Yeah.
I'm familiar with it, but I have not seen it, honestly. And it hasn't been widely shown
in this country. No.
Do you have a directing co-direction?
Yeah, I co-directed it with Larry. Yeah. It was something. I met Larry Clark at. I was in this art fair in Graz, Austria, and I ended up at the same table with Larry Clark. And Robert Frank and Larry Clark were the two people why I got interested in photography, and because they imbued a subjectivity and personal connection,
yes,
to their images,
absolutely, yeah.
And so I said to Larry, "Your books, Teenage Lust and Tulsa, were like films in a way."
Yeah.
There was actually a story between the pages.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
I said to Larry, "Have you ever thought about making a film?"
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, "Hey, man, I always wanted to make a film. How do you make a film?" I go, "Oh, it's easy. Just hang out with me. What are you into?"
Yeah.
And he said he was in the skaters. I said, "Well, I was a skater when I was younger." And for me, I wanted to weigh into Larry Clark in what his world was. And so I was more than willing. So I said, "Did you ever keep a diary of your, like, what happened to you growing up that are in these books?" He said he did. So he went through his...
Did you have a sense that he might have done that, or that was just...
No,
a,
I, okay, I, I okay, said his okay. images were like a visual right, diary, because no, right. he told me he used sure. to... His mother was a baby photographer, and he would go after he would work with his mother and hang out with his friends and do drugs and take pictures. And so I said, "Did you..." So he had kept a diary of his
very good
mm-hmm. friends and his, you know, group. And so I said, "Well, would you show me those diaries?" So he showed me. So I said, "Look, we could use this for the context for ideas for a film," because I had just seen a film from Bloody Kids by Stephen Frears. He had done for the
love him, yeah.
BBC. And what I loved about the structure of the film was it told different stories that became one story. So about these kids. So I thought we could use the skate park as the nucleus for the story, and we could tell different stories of how these kids are connected through the skate park.
I kept saying the word kids and kids and this.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
So he had met Harmony in Washington Square Park, and I happened to kind of know Harmony because he was like a PA on Light Sleeper, Paul Schrader's film.
Yeah, right, which he shot, yeah.
So he said, "You know, we're like old guys. Why don't we give the diaries to somebody younger? I think this kid can write, you know," because we saw some of the things he had written.
Mm-hmm.
"And let's see what happens." So Harmony wrote the script, but then at that point in time, nobody knew who Larry Clark was in the cinema world.
No.
People barely knew who I was. And with that material, we couldn't get money to make a film. So then Larry met Gus Van Sant, and Gus gave him the opportunity, because it was AIDS-related projects, to do Kids, and he went back to Harmony. Harmony wrote the script, and then they took off. Then Larry was the great auteur, you know.
Yeah.
So then after that, we got to make Ken Park.
Wow.
So that was the evolution of it. But anyway, you asked me about Ulrich Seidel, so I'm sorry I got off on that tangent. So
you have to stop. You have to get out of the habit of apologizing, because if you listen to any of these shows here, you'll know that you're in great company of abusing the stray.
I'm not worried about it. All right.
No, I know.
So
Ken Park was shown at Telluride. Werner was there. Werner Herzog was there.
I know you mean by Werner. Yeah.
We'll see your viewers.
Yeah.
And he came out of the theater, and I was nervous, obviously. He came up to me and said, "Not bad, but that's kid stuff," to Ulrich Seidel. Who's Ulrich Seidel? He said, he's this filmmaker in Austria, in
this
Vienna.
Is Werner now.
Werner told me about Ulrich Seidel.
Okay.
So I was going that year to the Viennale in Vienna, which is their international film festival. So I had spoken to Hans Hork, who was the director of the festival, and said, "Could I see any of Ulrich's films? Werner told me about his films." So he put together like three or four films of Ulrich's, and some were documentaries. And I was just blown away. There's one film that still is my favorite of his, Losses to be Expected. And again, they border between narrative and documentary.
Yeah, sure.
And then Ulrich offered to have lunch with me, and we hit it off right away. He had seen Ken Park, and I don't know, we hit it off. Mm-hmm. And then I met him like a month later at ITFA in Amsterdam, at the International Documentary Film Festival of Amsterdam. And he offered me, he said, "Would you be interested to work with me on my next film, Import Export?"
Yeah, which
I go, wow, of course. Sure. He was surprised. I didn't think he thought I would be so interested, you know, to go to Austria being for, you know, he shoots forever, you know, like over a year on and off.
Oh, he does.
So this is another unique thing that what he does. He shoots a scene and then goes in the editing room and then figures out where the characters are going in the story, and then goes out and shoots the next scene. There's no continuity to the shooting. So you shoot, you stop, you then prep.
Yeah.
From what he's, in other words, the shooting becomes the script. And that's why there's such an interesting organic feeling to his storylines.
And this natural realism thing, it makes perfect sense as you know, if you're watching The Paradise.
So I was so interested to see his technique and how he worked.
Yeah. Wow. You just have to really be open-minded. I mean, obvious thing to say it, but it's true. And you have to just be so, ready to... it's just have to be able to embrace any course of action, right,
but,
or direction, don't you?
Images are about what you experience with your camera. It's not like some rigid idea that you have written
down and that you impose on each project.
You know, that's not what I've been interested in. I was always interested, even in art school, the found object, you know, the Dadaist, and then later the German Expressionism. And so I was always interested in, and I think that's why I studied painting, and I didn't like being alone in a room with a blank canvas, you know. Mm-hmm. I like the idea that I engage with other people, one, creating something, and two, participating with the subject matter, telling a story. Mm-hmm. Once I realized you could find images and construct those images to tell a story, that's what really drew me into making films and being a cinematographer. And I mean, and I ended up being, I actually started out as, I don't know, filmmaker, image maker, whatever you want to call it. But then people always liked the way my stories were told because I thought about painters, because painters always came from different movements because of their social, political, economic context. So I thought you could do that in cinema. You know, you could look at things in different ways to create those images, that they don't have a cookie cutter, you know, close up, medium, long shot, backlight, side light, you know, fill light, you know, that images can come out of the experience you're having with space and time and light and the subject matter.
But it seems like then you're taking an intellectual approach to organic, reflecting on an organic, like in a movement is generally thought of as an organic thing, right? Like you just said, it's the result of all these different things that happen to be taking place in one time, right?
Yeah.
You're sort of making an intellectual decision, to borrow that.
I like to do the research before, but then be totally open when I'm in the moment with the subject matter, when I'm lighting or, you know, like when I go in a room, when I'm lighting a set, I'm very affected by why the room looks the way it does, because the window is there and the door is there. And and of course, then I want to stage the action ways I know they'll implement the story. But I even if I take like a manneristic look like Douglas Sirk in Far From Heaven, I still kind of start from a certain reality to implement color or implement light. You know, when I did a film like very early on, like Desperately Seeking Susan, you know, the crew looked at me like, you're weird. Why is it so yellow and green in the streets? You know, because I was thinking about German expressionism and this story made no sense to me, this kind of screwball 40s comedy, you know. So I wanted to create this foreboding, frightening world of Madonna's world for Roseanne Arquette, the housewife in Suburbia. So I thought, what better way to do it than think about Nodal and Kirshner and German expressionism? And they didn't use naturalistic colors. They used very expressionistic colors, because color to me, and always for me, is a psychological means of expressing something about the image than just a pictorial representational way. So I just pushed, in my mind, fluorescent light, sodium vapor light that has a bluish green look, or tungsten lights, which would be, you know, car lights or lights in windows, yellow. So I just thought, well, you could just push that to create this world that the Madonna character is in the Lower East Side is living.
And somebody like Susan Seidelman, right?
Yes, Susan Seidelman. And I had a great Santo LaCosta. That was his first. He did the production design and costume.
Oh, my gosh, right. Well, those stand out.
And he came from theater, you know, from Yale. And so it was great collaboration. He got it right away, that we don't have to do something naturalistic, that we could do it, you know, more mannered. And
because it's this...
create the artifice of the world to the story.
And it's a comedy. It's a screwball comedy. So,
which I still didn't get, but
Madonna, she was game. She obviously wasn't part of this conversation. She didn't know what was going on. She's just showing up, right?
Yeah.
Prepared?
Yeah, she was very professional. That was her break. She was like, you know.
She was hungry. And
she was like, you know, part of the downtown scene.
Sure.
Yeah, in fact, the studio didn't even want her. Susan had the fight for her.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they didn't know who Madonna was.
Right. You know? She was big. She was sort of on the rise downtown, but I don't know. I mean, I guess
I think her big hit by then was Borderline or something.
Yeah, sure. Now that we explored a few of your collaborations, where did you grow up?
I should grow up in northern New Jersey, Morristown, New Jersey.
Morristown. My dad lived in the Morris Plains.
Oh, right next door.
Yeah.
My father owned a movie theater in Boonton, New Jersey. My grandfather was an exhibitor and owned eight movie theaters in Jersey. He was actually, it's funny, my mother's side, Hungarian, and he was in the liquor business. And when Prohibition came in, he got into vaudeville theaters, and then the vaudeville theaters became movie houses.
Right.
So I was around film my whole life, but I never took it very seriously until I took this gut course at Harvard in film appreciation with Dwight McDonald. And I go, wow, there's a reason images are up there on the screen. And I should have known better because I never knew what was going on in a film, but I always remembered the images in a film.
So it all seems rather predetermined on some level here that you ended
up. I abhorred cameras. My father was an amateur photographer, and I had this weird notion like it steals your soul. Now I know it does.
That's a.
But I kept myself away from cameras. It was really interesting because my father was an amateur photographer.
You wanted to go the opposite.
Yeah, and I just.
Mm-hmm. So an early project, maybe the first, was you were an assistant, maybe a director on Lords of Flatbush. Is that right? I only bring you because that's
no,
one of the.
I took over Lords. Lords of Flatbush started as Sexual Freedom in Brooklyn. These two guys, they were agents, Steve Arona and Marty Davison, were these two agents. They were always, they didn't have any money, and then they would raise money. And then they hired me to, I reshot most of the film. Okay. And there was Sylvester Stallone and Henry Winkler.
Perry King, was he?
And was he Susie one Blakely. And,
wow.
And it was like the East Coast version of,
American Graffiti.
Exactly. Yeah. And it became a big hit. And
It was like this, one of those early films I remember when I was just kind of coming of age, that I remember very distinctly, just being so popular and so, such a it movie at that moment in time for the kids my age,
Yeah, we shot in 16 millimeter slow stock, like ASA 25. It was a real lesson in survival, that film.
In survival?
Well,
yeah.
I could do it.
Yeah, because you had, you had the director now all of a sudden. But did you have, you had to reshoot the film, right?
I reshot a lot of it,
okay.
Yeah.
But you were now in charge of the set, too, right?
Yeah.
So you're, you're a
director of photography, not director.
Okay,
right,
but with so when you reshot it, you were still working with the original director.
Yeah, I was out of maybe film school.
Okay. Right, yeah. So you're shooting on the streets of Brooklyn.
Yeah, under the boardwalk.
In Coney Island?
Coney Island.
Yeah. Wow. That was a long time back, wasn't it? It's just amazing how you seem to have, you're a kind of a zealot in a way of working with all these, being in the right time at the right place and working with all these rather remarkable collaborations, because you mentioned Paul Schrader is another collaboration.
Well, I think I always thought film was an art form more than a job. I was, I don't know. I went to art school, and so I thought, well, that's what I wanted to do or could do. And I was fortunate enough to, be able. And then I think because I seeked out the people that I most respected. Like, even when I was, a cinematographer in the 70s, I worked with Robbie Mueller, who was Vin Vendors.
Just going to bring him up. Yeah, collaborator for many.
I worked on American Friend in New York, Amerikanisch Freund. And then I went and did films with Vim, Lightning Over Water. But that was really crucial to me that I got to work with someone like Robbie Mueller. And then from Robbie Mueller, I worked with Sven Nyquist.
Yeah.
And then from Sven Nietland, bad films, you know, King of the Gypsies and Hurricane. But
that was with Eric Roberts?
Yeah, Eric Roberts, yeah.
I kind of found that to be such an outrageous film. It's very I found it to be very watchable, even though it's so over the top.
I haven't seen it. What, yeah. Which one?
Oh, just, it was so outrageous.
King of the Gypsies.
Yeah, just the performances. It was just it's like this outrageous, crazy film. Yeah. But for some reason, I got really... Anyway.
And then I got to where I met Bertolucci. I did my thesis on Prima della Revolution, before the revolution.
Right.
And I would go to the press screenings. I'd sneak into the press screenings at the New York Film Festival. And that year was Bernardo Bertolucci. And nobody even knew who Bernardo Bertolucci was then. And that's the year he showed The Conformist and The Spider Stratagem. So I met him. He didn't speak much English.
He still doesn't.
I spoke to him in... No, he speaks perfect English.
No.
But
he did this podcast.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. It was on the phone.
Oh.
With his last film.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, I was a bit blown away.
But he calls me his first American fan. So I talked to him in all of the lines from before the revolution. I said, my shoes are from Parma, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, meaning you have middle class values, but you have leftist leanings, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he was so taken back by, who is this weird American, you know, that's into Italian, you know, politics and history and whatever, and his cinematic language. And he invited me in his box to see The Conformist, the first screening of
At
Alice Tully
Hall.
You're in the box? I almost fell out of the box when he said, what did I think? And that was... So yeah. I met, you know, became friends with Bernardo.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he came to New York to shoot La Luna, I was the New York standby DP and did second unit on La Luna for Storaro. And then later I was on the set of One from the Heart with Godard doing another film. So that was my best film school, to have Robbie Muller, Sven Nyquist, and Victoria Storaro to be in their presence on a set.
Yeah. It's remarkable. Just don't get caught in a panel with Vittorio. That's what I learned last time I saw you two together.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I'm
joking.
Gave him his...
You know, I know you did. Although you two, I do want to bring it up, you two kind of, not directly clashed, but clashed in terms of your philosophy, because he's now, at least as he says, and I find it a little dubious, truthfully, like in a private room, I don't know if he would say that, speak the same way about embracing the digital.
Oh, no, he's definitely embraced the digital.
You think that he doesn't still have a...
No. He's definitely embraced it hook, line, and sinker.
Oh, so he drank the...
He drank the Kool-Aid, yeah.
And
but
so
that,
that's,
you know,
how
that's
got
fine.
Woody Allen,
know?
To start shooting digital. But you in a very succinct way, allowed him to talk for his half hour, and then you said, well, I'm going to have to... if not, I don't know if you were use the word disagree, but, you know, you said, well, I believe that any artist should have the full palette of all the tools.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be limited by only the digital world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at images and the tools we use to create those images, they affect what the story is. And for me, the aspect of the digital world is wonderful in documentary because of the immediacy of it, the how small and compact the camera is, but also it creates kind of a photorealistic look of the world. Now, we can do things to try to alter that look, certainly. But for me, film has more depth than the digital world. And I could explain why, you know, that... Film has these three layers, RGB, the colored layers, and light etches its way in like an etching, you know, exposing the three layers. And then light is used to project that image Where digitally, it's all on one pixel fixated frame, light, dark, and color. And it's electronic. And for me, it lacks a certain depth to the image. And also, grain that is so inherent in film has, for me, kind of an anthropomorphic feeling of living in the surface of your image because it's moving. You know, highlights have fine grain. Low lighting has large grain. And that grain moves from frame to frame. And when you move the camera, it's also moving. And now we can mimic that somewhat digitally, but it's not the same. So it's just, you know, why you use one paintbrush over another? Why use one color over another? So all those things affect the subtext or the emotion of how a viewer experiences something. So I just don't want to limit that. You know, I'm not going to be pejorative, and the digital world is here to stay. But a lot of the digital medium now is being driven by the marketing, you know, 8K, 6K, you know, HD, you know, ultra vision or whatever, you know, HDC or whatever the hell it is. That cameramen don't necessarily want that. You know, now they have this thing that extends the range of your exposure. Well, that's my job, is to create what the range of that negative is. I don't want to then go into post and now my highlights are blown out and my shadow detail is, you know, lost, or I know where I want that image to be.
Sure. There's nothing worse than looking at an HD shot thing on an HD TV. It just I don't know. I'm like, why are we watching this? It just looks like a news program.
Right.
I just don't have any interest. It just loses all texture. Yeah, well, your
eye and my eye has been trained through the photographic media, and maybe younger people, their eye is trained differently than ours, so they like that. Yeah. I'm not going to say it's wrong. It's just, it's not my aesthetic. That's why people that hear records, and my ear isn't as good as other people, let's say, they know why they like to hear sound or music through records over, you know, a
over
MP4
an MP3 or
three or whatever.
An MP4 too, yeah. They both exist. Well, I think you should just told Vittorio to shut up, put him in his place. And now I'm kidding around. But it was still a very exciting event to go to last. I think it was at the New York Film Festival last year when that panel took place. That's when I think one of the first times I approached you, accosted you, however you may want to describe it, and about doing something like this with me.
But even color is rendered differently in the digital media than in film. The colors aren't represented the same way. And I've tried to create, with gels, a similar look that I get out of film, and it's different.
What do you mean by that, creating it with gels?
Well, I use gels to create different looks, you know.
Where are these gels, though? I mean, just literally.
On the lights.
On the lights themselves.
Yeah, they do them with LEDs. You can change the color in an LED. But, yeah, there's always subtle things you can do with gels to bring out, you know, the environment or the...
I see. Sounds like it feels like cheating a little bit. Like you could just use film and achieve that.
No, that's part of the tool of creating the image, you know?
Yeah. I was just with a friend. We were seeing the Gus Van Sant film.
The which?
This new Gus Van Sant film.
Oh, yeah.
I was with this friend of mine. He's an actor and a writer, and he when he heard I was coming here, he was very, very excited. He said, "That's wonderful. He really loves your work." And he was bringing up Light Sleeper, but he had just seen a copy of Medium Cool, the Haskell Wexler film at Anthology Film Archives, and he said it was not a remastered copy. He said it was fantastic. And I said, well, that film in particular really would benefit from just leaving it alone. I mean, you know, you don't want a film in disrepair, but the pops and the and seeing the film in its most sort of just, I don't know, organic state, whatever, you know, right. That film in particular really it would enhance the experience, you know. Seeing that remastered, just it would seems like that would actually take away from the experience.
But remastered to what format?
I don't know, digitally and you know, like some 4K.
I'll say this in a weird way. Let's take a film like Far From Heaven. When I see that on a DVD, that feels more like film because it's lower resolution.
I see what you mean.
When I've seen that film, I have a Blu-ray of the film.
Far From Heaven.
Far From Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It looks digital. It doesn't look like the film I shot.
Interesting.
So this whole idea of like up-resing everything, you know, even in Blu-ray, can change the look of your film. It doesn't look like film anymore. It looks like I shot it digitally. That's so weird.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah. I don't understand the appeal, but you know,
it's marketing. It's selling equipment. It's selling TV sets. HDC, is that what it is? The high definition HD, what is it? There's this new HD television, HDC.
Oh boy, I'm out of my league now. There's a new. It's a new technology. It's brand. Is it new?
What is it? High bandwidth digital content protection. Yeah, but what's it called? What's the letters?
HDCP.
What?
HDCP. Right? Is that what you said? Yeah. HDCP. So it's HDC. Maybe HDCP. Some cases. HDCP.
All right.
Or, yeah. Doesn't matter.
This
we know
high definition HCDP.
Right.
That. They're pushing on us now. We don't want it.
No, exactly.
If I wanted that look, I would have created that look when I was photographing it, right. Originating the image. Yeah. I don't want to change what I did on set. I spent all my time and energy creating a certain aesthetic on the set that then I don't want to change later. Now, here's something I just read about. They're coming out with LCD movie screens that now the theater that the images are in can just make it whatever they want. They say, oh, that film was too dark. They can just
turn up the light.
Make it as bright as they want. They're LCD, you know, diodes. The only good thing I read about is like $800,000 to re-outfit a movie theater with it, so not too many theaters are going
to
go
it.
With it.
Right.
But that is like the worst.
Who are they trying? I guess they're just, like you say, selling. It's all about selling a bill of goods. But, you know, because I'm wondering, like, why don't we hear enough about people pushing back, you know?
We're trying. We're trying to hold on the film, you know? That's the whole reason. Kodak now is opening labs,
right?
Because they know if they market, if they're going to sell film, they have to have a place to develop it.
Yeah, it seems like we had to go through a cycle of saying, "Oh, this really isn't. I'm not experiencing something aesthetically pleasing." Well, ultimately, and the same thing happened though with vinyl. The reason it's come back, well, partly because of DJs, but it's also partly because of what you said before about just the audio, the sonic aesthetic to it.
Right. But people get lazy.
And it was such a mark. I bought into it. I was like still kind of young, and the idea of CDs, and then you replaced it and got rid of your vinyl. It was like, then you're realizing, what have I done?
Yeah.
This is, what have I done?
Well, because people are under the false illusion that technology drives the language of what we say, and it doesn't. Technology should implement what we say. It shouldn't be the thing that motivates what we do. You know, I don't know if I said that exactly right. Technology shouldn't be the thing that pushes our stories. Our stories should push the technology.
Yes. Right.
And
yeah.
It's never going to be the easy way out. And so once everybody figures out it's not the end all, then they come back to works. You know, ultimately, you know, why are we telling our stories? We want to connect to the viewer what the emotions are in the stories. And are we going to put things between us and the viewer that separate creating those emotions? It's like they're experimenting with different frame rates for us to view films, you know, like higher resolution with a frame rate.
Mm-hmm.
And they find people don't like that. You know, they're shooting, you know, 60 and 120 frames.
Right.
And they find it's actually bothers people. But again, you know, there's nothing wrong with people experimenting with it and trying it. But then you have to deal with the reality, you know, like 24 frames per second. There's some reason why we respond to that. Speed. In our head,
right?
In our...
Yep. Yeah. What are you working? You have a couple of things coming out just right now.
I'm doing a documentary with Todd Haynes now about the Velvet Underground. A lot of compilation footage, and we're doing, you know, original interviews. You know, originating some interviews with people that are still part of the, you know, was in the art scene and in the scene and
orbiting that band at that time. Yeah.
And John Cale, we just did. And then I'm talking to people about a new project, but it's too early to talk about it.
And I also would be, well, we didn't really get into Schrader too much, but Light Sleeper being a favorite. And by the way, did you catch up with First Reformed?
Cause I think it's brilliant.
You did see it.
I saw it at Talleyrand. It's brilliant.
Yeah. I love that too. I got, you know, and I had an opportunity to talk to Paul Schrader, you know, since then. And it was quite.
Yeah, he's so articulate, but that film is really brilliant. Like everything comes together in that film.
It does. And, you know, you can appreciate it on an intellectual level, but it really works emotionally.
Oh, it works. It works on every level. That's when a work really is there, you know, when it can work on other levels, you know.
Sure. Yeah. The only other person I kind of have to ask about, because you did do one collaboration with Robert Altman, right? And
yeah, he was wonderful. I mean, the incredible thing about Altman
is... That was his last film, too, right?
Was it his last film, Prairie Home Companion.
Prairie Home Companion.
We were actually in prep
on another
film called Hands on a Hard Body.
That was a documentary, wasn't it?
No, there was a documentary, and that was what the film was based on.
Yeah,
in Texas, this car dealership where people put their hands on the car.
And it's a contest.
Whoever lasts, like a week later, 4 or 5 days later, gets the car.
Right.
So everybody does everything to, like, stay awake or asleep, but holding their hands on the car.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. Yeah.
Anyway, that was
going to be
basis.
A narrative
right.
based on the documentary or that story, anyway. The same
right. But the great thing about Altman was the sense of improvisation. In other words, like, he loved jazz, and you realize the way he used the camera was like improvisational jazz, in the sense he would have two or three cameras on track, on a crane, moving all the time, knowing he could cut in and get pieces, but he wanted the sense of discovery for the audience to experience that performance.
Mm-hmm.
And it gave great energy to the actors. And I've never met a director that had the courage to believe they could get footage out of that. It means you have to have great operators and great dolly grips, and everybody has to be on their game that you're capturing the moments. You're capturing, but he would say, let's boogie, and then you do another take, you know? And that was a great experience. And I always heard from other cameramen he was very difficult to work with, because they would say, well, I don't have any place to put my lights. You know, and he goes, well, that's your problem. But by then, Wow. When I shot this, it was in a theater, and I could motivate the light from all the stage lighting. So I didn't have that problem.
Really?
And I knew that, so I built the lighting into the set.
Did you get any of the lighting people from the theater to help you with that?
Yeah, it was the stage performance crew?
Right.
So I had the stage lighting, and then I implemented the lighting around the stage, and then when we're in the diner, I'm using the fluorescent fixtures in the diner. So I knew that you shoot 360 degrees. You didn't know where the camera was going to be at that moment in time. So I lit it that way. And he was like, there was one scene he thought, oh, I'm going to get him this time. It was downstairs in the dressing rooms where he wanted to do these moving shots with mirrors. There was the mirror that they're looking in. There's mirrors on the table. But I put my grip, came up with the idea. We had every mirror on a gimbal so we could rotate the mirrors. So when the camera moved by, we could alter the mirror's position so we wouldn't see ourselves in the mirror.
Foiled again.
What?
Foiled again. Yeah, Robert Altman's perspective.
He appreciated it. Yeah, I mean, that was, you know.
Yeah.
And then the lighting was all in the over the mirrors, like the makeup mirrors. So that was my lighting. I used the light that would be in the makeup mirrors. And then my other trick, I had one other great trick. I used his son, who is a great operator, who's a DP now, his son's Bob Altman Jr. And so if I really needed something, I would say, could you ask your dad if we could just move over a foot to that direction?
Oh.
And he would go to his dad and he said, yeah, sure. He would always give in to his son. So that was my secret way to
get
my way if I needed it. You know? But he was great. He was like...
That sounds great. It sounds like, and you had a lot of great success and good fortune with a lot of your collaborations. It sounds like you haven't had too many.
Sure.
I mean, I wouldn't be focusing on the less successful collaborations, I suppose. Anyway, but it sounds like you've had a good streak.
Yeah, I always said you don't always make the right choices, but I always said I didn't want to shoot a script or a film that I didn't want to go see myself.
Yeah.
You're not. I generally would base the reasons why I wanted it to work on a project because of the passion of the director and the people involved with the story. It was never based on budget or how big the crew or how many lights. It was always based on what the material was and the passion of the director.
Right.
And they would let me collaborate with them.
Right.
I can deal with anything except egos, you know.
Well, you've had to have. Altman did not have a big ego. Of course he did.
No, it was about the work.
It
was about the work.
Okay, that's great. I guess I shouldn't have said that. I mean, I don't know why.
You can say that.
I mean,
it's good.
He's one of my favorites.
I don't want to mention the people that I didn't work with because I felt their ego was more important than what their work was.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
But there are those people.
I bet. No, I bet. And I imagine they're more frequently than not. Comes along with being...
And I actually like working with women directors because I always found this personally, that women are more collaborative about the process and don't make the ego the part of the process. I think they're so appreciative that... No, I'll say it this way. I like working with first-time directors because they're open to anything. They don't know what problems they're going to get themselves into.
And they lucked out with Ed Lockman as their DP.
They take bigger chances,
You
know?
Yes.
Or directors that have their own language, you know, that are
unique.
Experienced. And so you plug into what their vision is, you know, and you collaborate and see how you can contribute to them.
Yeah.
And I have to say I've had great experiences working with women because I don't find the ego is the male alpha ego is involved with the creative process, that, it, that there's kind of a real equality about what the work is.
I have to apologize to listeners, female listeners especially, because I don't think we've dwelled on too many. I mean, I know we mentioned Susan Seidelman, who was an early collaborator, but I
work with...
I think I've left out. I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. Stacey Cochran, Deborah Kampmeyer on Hound Dog.
I haven't seen that one. I don't think. I think I haven't
else?
Seen that one.
I'm a number of women. Oh, Sofia Coppola. How do we forget her?
I don't think it's... I don't know. That was egregious, though. Of course, Sofia Coppola. You had one collaboration with her, though, right?
Yeah.
Did you work with her
once?
Virgin Suicides. So that was not only a female, but that was her first feature, too, right?
Yeah.
I think that was... So that was where she... Where both... She must have been open to be working with a first... Because
yeah,
she was a first-time filmmaker.
Both fronts, right.
And not much ego there. That's good to hear, right?
Who?
And no ego there, you're saying.
Yeah, no, about the work.
Yeah.
Anne and Jan Petrie on the Mother Teresa film. But anyway, you wouldn't have to listen, but I'm just...
I know.
In a general sense, I...
For every... there has to one day be a part two to this, because there's so many... This was, but you know, it was very satisfying. This because while I may be out of my depth a little bit because of a limited technical knowledge about how lenses work with light and, you know, the actual science and art of cinematography.
Yeah,
no,
well,
but
I,
that, you don't.
Not,
I know you didn't get carried away.
I rather talk about the aesthetics than
the aesthetics,
technical, because
sure.
I only learned the technical end after I figure out what the aesthetics should be about the film.
That makes sense. Because again, right, the aesthetics, the technology should follow the story,
right,
as you said very articulately before, not the opposite way.
I mean, images are the metaphor for the storytelling. They're the subtext of the story you're telling. And
right.
What makes theater or literature different than film? It's images, and it's images filtered through the optics of the camera that create the thematic. And I say it this way in a weird way. In film, you can show place where you are, but it's much harder to enter the interior world of the character. Where in literature, it's much easier to enter the interior world of the character. You can say how they think, feel, what they're going to... But it takes much more effort to say where you are, place. So it's the exact opposite approach to how you tell a story. And I'm always trying to, with the director, find the interior world of the character, that the interior world is expressed through the external imagery.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much. Yeah, this was wonderful.
I hope it wasn't too much blah, blah, blah.
It's all blah, blah, blah all the time. That's
we should have done this show with an image, not...
Now you're telling
all
me.
The narrative.
Now you're telling... It's right, ironically, this is just all...
Couldn't we somehow get an image through this, their ears? Like,
yeah, well,
like Wonderstruck was about...
I was going to just say
hearing with images.
Yeah, that's right.
That was the problem. That was what we tried to do in Wonderstruck, about these two characters that are deaf,
right,
two different time periods.
That's right.
And how they experience their world through images that replace their heightened sense of what they've lost in sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's most recent to Todd Haynes again, right? Yeah. Do you think that worked successfully? Do you think people got that?
I think that film is brilliant. And I think that's a film that was kind of not appreciated.
Maybe not. Maybe the people just didn't
know. Using the 20s, because that, which was part of the thematic of the story, the young girls and her relationship to her mother, who's a silent screen actress and seeing it as a silent film, shooting black and white negative, not digitally, not creating a monochromatic image through color film, but actually shooting black and white film, which I had to get Kodak to make the film and then get a lab to process the film. And then telling the story like a silent movie for that part of the story. And then the 70s that you find out what the connection is between these two stories is shot like the street scenes of the French Connection.
Sure, right.
You know,
yeah.
to create that world of for this young boy coming to this city and being dislocated and losing his hearing. So
right.
What better way to do that than through the reality-based films of the 70s?
Yeah. No, I thoroughly enjoyed that. Of course, I got that film, Wonderstruck. But then again, was able to sit with Todd in a room for and talk to him, too. So I'm grateful for that opportunity from that film, that film gave me.
Mm-hmm.
So very selfishly, I am. We'll see you in a couple of months and back at the Walter Reed, I assume, or you'll be back there?
Yeah,
for
I hope so.
Screening.
I like looking at other people's films as maybe more than making them.
That's more recent, I take it, or has that always been the case? Has that always been the case? Or is it more recently that you're kind of...
I don't know. I think, you know...
Yeah. Comes and goes, those feelings. I understand. Maybe by the fall.
The films are always the best when it's a wrap.
I totally get that. Who was it that said, I think it was like a Lillian Hellman or one of those old, you know, crusty writers, definitely female, who said she hates writing, but she loves having written.
Yeah.
You know, makes sense.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. Thank you very
All
much.
Right.
I appreciate you making the time.
Thank you.
I know you're busy, and thank you for inviting me in. And me and Noah up here to your loft. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
In 1950, when I was born, Papa couldn't.